Down in Carlisle lived a lady. She was so beautiful and gay, and she determined to live a lady, and no young man could her betray. But soon she met two loving brothers. They came to her from afar, and there upon these loving brothers this lady cast her heart's desire. One of them was a bow lieutenant, a bow lieutenant, a man of war. The other was a bossy captain, belonged to a ship called Colonel Carr. Up spoke this handsome lady, saying, "I cannot be but one man's bride, but meet me here tomorrow morning. On this case we will decide." She called for her horses and her coaches, and they were ready at her command. And then together these three did wander, until they came to a lion's den. And there they stopped, and there they halted, with these two brothers musing round. 'Twas for the space of half an hour that she lay speechless on the ground. But at length she did recover, and threw her fan in the lion's den, saying, "Which of you to gain a lady will return to me my fan?" Up spoke this bold sea captain. He raised his voice so loud above, saying, "Madam, I'm a man of honor, but I will not lose my life for love." And then up spoke this bold lieutenant. He raised his voice so loud and high, saying, "Madam, I'm a man of honor. I will return your fan or die." Down in the lion's den he ventured, where the lions look so grim. He whooped and raged all among them, until at last he did return. And when she saw her lover coming, and unto him no harm was done, she threw herself upon his bosom, saying, "Here, young man, is the prize you won." And then up spoke that bold sea captain, like a man all trouble with a wandering mind, saying, "Through these lonely woods I'll ramble, where no man can ever me find." I believe I'd have went off and hid too, Junior.
It's another Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. A couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of visiting with Wayne Caldwell, one of our finest mountain riders, author of Cataloochee, the remarkable historical novel that portrays the development of a mountain community. Today, Wayne will share part of that novel and read as well from his new book, Requiem by Fire. Let's listen to our conversation. It's been about a year, I guess, since we sat down and talked in front of a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, Cataloochee has been on the market. You've been doing reading tours, all manner of things that authors do. What has that been like?
Well, To be honest with you, I have really enjoyed it. I'm a very introverted person. And I told my wife, Mary, at one point that I was going to have to find my inner extrovert to get out here and enjoy this. And I think I found the guy.
Well, good.
It is very, very nice to go to a group of people who have read your book and are curious about it and want to hear you read. That is just a very gratifying thing. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not real gratifying to drive a couple of hundred miles and read to an audience of three, one of whom is a customer in a bookstore and the other two are employees, which happened to me one night. But, you know, you take the good with the bad.
Yes,
in
it's
this
all
business.
Part of
But the people that I really enjoy reading to most are groups like Friends of Libraries, who are by definition readers and people who support the arts and that sort of thing. And I can draw a crowd for that kind of group and really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. A lot of good energy at meetings like that. And, of course, the local bookstores here, Accent on Books and Malaprops, both have been just wonderful hosts and all of that. So, I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah. So, at the same time you've been out on the road, of course, you've been writing your second book, which I understand is now done. Is that?
Well, it's
any truth to that rumor?
My original turn-in date for the book was August 30th, and I fudged on that by about a week and sent them a version the first week in September. And my editor said, after she read it, she said, "You know, this is good. I don't have to clean up after you. I like that. I like to hear them say that." But she also said there are a few things in here that need to be developed a little bit better. And so I have since then written three extra chapters, rewritten one, rearranged a couple of things. And I've got a stack of paper in front of me that I'm still working on this weekend and hope to turn it in Sunday night, as a matter of fact. Uh-huh. And I think this will make my editor, Laura, happy. And I know it makes me happier because it's a better book now.
Yeah.
I was reading the other day, for example, chapters that were going from 1930 to 31 to 32 to 33, and all of a sudden there was a chapter that was back in 1931, and I said, you know, I really need to move that.
Or maybe you're just playing with temporality.
No. We're not doing that in this book. I occasionally will be in 1930 or 31, and I will backtrack to the 1860s or something, simply to introduce a family. But that's as complicated as I'm getting with time in this book. What I'm finding out, interestingly enough, is that that is confusing to readers these days, and I'm scratching my head and wondering why. I used to scratch my head at Don Barthelme, for example, but you're supposed to scratch your head at that.
Right.
I mean,
that was
this
the whole point.
exactly. But this is not that kind of thing.
Oh, I wonder how he would tackle the historical novel.
I really don't know.
I have to think about that. Yeah. Well, more than most novels, even most historical novels, Cataluzzi really is about a community of people. And does that continue to be the case in the second book as well?
What I think I'm showing in the two books, if you place them together, is kind of an arc or a parabola or whatever the geometric figure is there. The historical Cataluzzi, at its peak, probably in the early 1920s, had about 1,250 residents. By the mid-30s, I don't know exactly what the population was, but I'm guessing it was probably around 100.
Wow.
And, you know, in my book, I'm taking a little, quite a bit more liberties, what you might call poetic license, in the second book. And by 1935 or so, it would seem that there are only about 20 or 25 people left in the valley. Uh-huh. And one of them is a warden, and, you know, they're just really there's not many people left living there. Mm-hmm. Now, I know the historical Cataluche, they kept a schoolhouse running until probably the early 60s.
Really?
Or something like that. Uh-huh. But I'm not interested in being that accurately reflective mm-hmm. of the historical record mm-hmm. in this. What I'm trying to show is the rise in book one of a community, and then the government comes in and says, we are going to take this land and we're going to change it into something else. I'm awfully glad the government came in and did that, because otherwise there'd be condominiums all over every ridge and all of that sort of thing, and my ancestral stomping ground would be gone.
Right.
But
golf courses.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But on the other, yeah, wouldn't that big valley in Cataluche make a wonderful golf course?
Right.
So I'm glad the government did that. But what I'm also trying to say here is there was a human cost to that. And the decline of the community is what I'm most interested in the second volume.
Mm-hmm.
The title that I'm using for the second volume right now is Requiem by Fire. And you've got two elements there. You've got the rest that Requiem implies,
right,
as in rest in peace and all that sort of thing. And then we're doing it by fire. Fire starts out in this book being something that is warm, something that reminds you of home. It's something that's supposed to be on the hearth.
Right.
It's something that cooks for you. It's your friend. And by the end of this book, fire is something which is very destructive and is shown probably most in its worst light when the government decides to burn the structures in Cataluche.
Right, I was thinking that was how they were brought down.
Yeah, you can come into the valley now and you can think, well, how nice. Here's four or five houses and a couple of churches and a school. But I wonder where everybody else lived. Well, those houses didn't just fall down.
No.
The government burned them.
Right.
And I think that's just an awful shame, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
And it makes a mighty handy literary motif for someone who's trying to make a point. So.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I know in Cataluche, what anthropologists call the material culture was so richly revealed. You've obviously done so much research onto how people actually lived. I mean, what tools they used, what mm-hmm. cookware,
right,
what brands of flour were available on the shelves, etc. I mean, it's just have you found it easier to write the second book in that respect? I mean, it's closer to our own time.
Well, really only about 3 or 4 or 5 years closer to our own time.
Yeah.
The research was basically done for the first book.
Right.
So this one has been easier in that sense. It's been a little more difficult in another sense because I have had certain things that I have wanted to happen at certain times, and they totally go against the historic record. And
oops.
I've seen, well, the question that a historical novelist comes to is, what can I legitimately ignore mm-hmm. about the historic record? And what do I have to be bound by?
Right, right.
One of the interesting points in here is the fact that the superintendent, the first superintendent for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, did not show up until 1931.
Mm-hmm.
The government began taking land in 1928, so there's 3 years where there was not even really an acting superintendent for the park. And I wanted the superintendent there before.
Uh-huh.
so the government presence would be in there and be real and that sort of thing. And
right.
I tried to bend it, and that little fact wouldn't bend.
Yeah.
And the other day I realized that and just had to put this chapter back where it belonged,
uh-huh.
Or up where it belonged, actually. So that's a tightrope thing that you walk. The character, well, here's another thing that I decided just to ignore. The character Silas Wright is based on a historical person who is Stephen Woody. And Uncle Stephen Woody, I don't remember exactly when he died, but it was somewhere around 1940,
mm-hmm.
and stayed in the valley basically most of that time from 28 into 40. I chose to have this character die earlier than that, just to illustrate the dying of the community. And here's the elder person in the community who's gone now, and who is left going to do? And that's the question that the book ends on. It's really kind of a sad tale.
Yeah.
I think this is a better book than Cataluchi, in that it's more unified, and it is more plot-driven, I guess you would say. Although I still don't know what overarching plot means, and I really don't care. it's a little bit more focused than Cataluchi was.
Yeah. Does it have a smaller cast of characters by virtue of the...
Yeah. Well, I thought so.
Uh-huh.
So this week I took a couple of days off, and one of the things I did was read through the text, and I just wrote down all of the named characters. There were 141 of them.
No kidding. Wow.
And a lot of them make one appearance, and then you don't see them again.
Right.
So I'm going to have to figure out this weekend how to deal with that.
Yeah.
But the first volume had probably 250. So.
Right. So still, right. We are working with a smaller cast.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe you should do one of those, trees of relationships and so on that, you know, like War and Peace has.
Right. Right. Well, we had a stab at that in Cataluchi. It was helpful, I think, but... I don't know what we'll do with Requiem. I would like to have a map. And they told me with Cataluchi I could have either the family tree or the map, but I couldn't have both. So we'll see what happens.
So now you've got a... Right. That's a tough call.
Yeah.
Continuation of the family tree of the...
If the book had been a New York Times bestseller for... 20 weeks or so, I could have whatever I wanted.
Oh, that's right. You could have. Yeah,
but we met the SIBA best-selling list, Southern Independent Booksellers list several times, but we didn't quite crack that New York Times deal. So I figure I'll have to fight about the art on this one. But that's okay. That's okay.
Oh, really? Well, you know, it takes it can take a while. I noticed Ron Rash with Serena has just now, after how many novels has Ron done?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Four or five anyway. And I told him a long time ago that Saints in the River was one of the few books I ever read that I wanted to be about 100 pages longer.
Yeah, it was really fine.
I knew that he had that longer book in him, and Serena just knocked me out when I read it a couple of months ago. Now, that's a plot-driven novel.
It is. It is indeed.
I am very proud of the boy for having written that.
Yeah. It's a mighty fine book. And it is indeed.
On a summer's day in the month of May, a burly bum came hiking down a shady lane through the sugar cane, looking for his liking. Hummed a song of a land of milk and honey, where a bum can stay for many a day, and he won't need any money. Oh, buzzing of the bees in the cigarette tree, by the soda water fountain, by the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings, in the big rock and mountain. In the big rock and the mountains, you never change your socks. Little streams of alcohol come trickling down the rocks. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, the barns are full of hay. I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the sleet don't fall and the wind don't blow. In the big rock and the mountains. Oh, buzzing bees in the cigarette tree, by the soda water fountain, by the lemonade.
cocks have wooden legs. The bulldogs all have rubber teeth. The hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The shacks all have to tip their hats. The railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and whiskey too. You can paddle all around it in the big canoe, in the big rock candy mountain. Saws nor picks. I'm bound to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work in the big rock candy mountain.
Listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 in Asheville, North Carolina. Now back to our conversation with Wayne Caldwell. Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we get you to read some of Cataluci, if you would, and then I'd love to hear some of the new book as well.
Okay. Well, I'd like to read a little section from Cataluci here that I did not read in public for a long time. I'm not quite sure why. But, the last few months I've been reading from it. And it's an interesting story because it's part of our Appalachian upbringing is that we tell tales.
Right.
Tall tales.
It was with the territory.
The Jack Tales being just one example of that kind of thing. And I really thought that oral tradition was dead.
Mm-hmm.
But one day, my late neighbor, Roy O'Kelly, just lives up the road here a little bit, I came home and his son's bird dog was in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the bird dog and I said, Linda, you ain't supposed to be here. What's going on? So I called Roy and I said, Roy, Linda's over here in my backyard. I come and get her. Well, he came over in about 15 minutes in his pickup truck, and we got talking after he'd put Linda in the cab. He told me a tall tale that I could not wait to get in the house and write down. And I didn't know anybody did this anymore.
That good, eh?
But it was good. He told it for the truth. But anyway, it's in the book here, and uh-huh. I kind of like to read that.
Well, do.
Just with the note that this story was actually told to me on a bright afternoon in maybe in October of about 2002.
Yeah.
So not that long ago.
Not that long ago.
The setting in the book is that a fellow named Bud Harrigan has come to board with Silas and Retta Wright. And Retta is one of these ladies who likes people to tell stories. And she's going to ask Bud if he'll tell a story for his dinner.
Okay.
And here's the story. I was in the fourth grade. There was some boys ahead of me, you know, seventh graders. Some of them was shaving. They'd been kept back so much. I was scared of them, mostly Billy Turner. Billy, he'd up in the morning ask the teacher if he could go. You know, to the outhouse. He'd go and come back and by and by another and do the same. They was going out to the creek where we kept our dinner buckets and eating the young'uns' dinners. We was too scared to tell on them, so they had a good business going. One day I told my old man I didn't get no dinner. Well, he knowed the teacher, Mr. Burris. He was a red-headed man with freckles all over his face. So Pap went over to his place and said, somebody smouched my dinner. Next morning, Mr. Burris sat on the edge of his desk and stared at us for a minute or two, tapping his britches leg with a ruler. Seemed like forever. And then he started telling us a story. Said when he was a pup, he done time in the penitentiary for stealing. Well, I looked at Billy Turner, and his face screwed up proper. Then Mr. Burris told it, kinder like this. First thing was, when I was 10, I started stealing lunches from the young'uns at school. I'd go out and eat me a sweet tater and come back. Then I'd get bold and clean out the whole bucket, ham, beans, taters, and all. Got away with it, too. Pretty soon, that wasn't enough. I'd steal crackers at the store, or snuff, or thimble, any old thing laying around. Then it got to be shotgun shells or a pack of cigarettes, and then I thought, well, sir, stealing's pretty good. I'd done left school by then, so you know what? My place was pretty ratty, so I figured I'd fix things up. I come upon a farm that was handy, and that night I got the hay out of the barn, took it home and hid it. Made several trips. But I got the house and the corn crib and the smokehouse and the outhouse and put them over at my place. I got the corn shocks and the pitchforks and the bee gums and every heifer, sheep, and chicken. Most trouble was the hogs. The last night I got the well. Dug it up and put it on my shoulders, and you know what? I was carrying it home when the high sheriff shined his light in my face and said, "Boy, it's all over for you." I did years of hard labor for that, and it wasn't a bit of fun. But you know what I learned in them years? I learned that there ain't nothing worth stealing. Not a cracker, not a farm, not a man's land, nothing. Then he sorted us into grades and started teaching. And not a one of us got our dinner stole after that. And I swear, that story was basically told to me in 2002 in this driveway right out here.
That's a classic old cautionary tale.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's a tale within a tale. It really reminds me of Scheherazade and some of those, you know, older oral traditions that you think about.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
What is it? The folklorists call it a frame tale.
Yeah,
I believe that's the academic way to put it. There were a lot of sources for Catalucci, but I really enjoyed my oral sources an awful lot.
Did you go out and interview people? I know you had a lot of oral sources just from family.
I didn't really do any formal interviewing. I guess about as formal an interview as I ever did was to go visit my cousin Raymond over at the Waynesville Country Club and have lunch with him one day. I had lunch with Stephen Woody one day downtown. We talked about Uncle Stephen Woody, his grandfather. Things like that, but there were never interviews that I actually took a tape recorder to did all that sort of thing
or
to sort of absorb it.
Yeah.
The notes were taken afterwards,
just
from memory.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can remember stuff too accurately to write about it too. That's another thing.
Yeah.
Say it isn't so. Say it isn't so. Everyone is saying you don't love me. Say it isn't so. Everywhere I go, everyone I know whispers that you're growing tired of me. Say it isn't so. People say that you found somebody new, and it won't be long before you leave me. Say it isn't true. Say that everything is still okay. That's all I want to know. And what they're saying, say it isn't so. Say it isn't so. Say it isn't so. Everyone is saying you don't love me. Say it isn't so. Everywhere I go, everyone I know whispers that you're growing tired of me. Say it isn't so. People say that you found somebody new, and it won't be long before you leave me. Say it isn't true. Say that everything is still okay. That's all I want to know. And what they're saying, please say it isn't so.
The great Billie Holiday there, of course. You're listening to WPBM 103.5 in Asheville, North Carolina. Now back to our conversation with Wayne Caldwell, author of Cataloochee. So in this, in Requiem by Fire, is that the, yeah, do you, does the folk tradition play a role in the same way as it does in Cataloochee?
Probably not as large a role. Although there's one folk motif that you find in particularly Southern literature. It's in Appalachian literature, but it's also in Faulkner. The idea that when you move from one place to another, you take your fire with you. Just because it's either good luck or it's, you know, just taking the nurturing that's been in your household with you. And one of my characters tries to do that, and the fire goes out during the move. And that is just an omen that is really bad. And for this particular family, it's horrible. Aunt Mary Carter, for example, well, for another example, is leaving the valley. You may remember in Cataloochee that she was given a clock for her 19th birthday by her husband Hiram. When she is seen leaving the valley, she is in the back of a truck holding that clock, making sure it doesn't fall out the back and bust, as they say.
Right.
And to me, that's an awfully powerful symbol that she's taking all of that time with her.
Yes.
But up in the cab of the truck is a bucket, and underneath all the insulation is coals from the fire. So she's taking that with her.
Yeah.
And I like to think that where she, when she got there, that hers were still alive.
Right. Right.
But there are things like that which obviously are folk motifs that that work in this book. But I don't recall any really elaborate stuff like that.
Maybe any more stories within stories?
Oh, I don't remember anything much about that. There's a section here that you might be interested in hearing about. We were talking about the decline of the community.
Right.
One of my characters is very, very loosely based on Mark Hanna, who was the first warden of the park. They called the rangers warden in the early day, wardens in the early days. And Mark was actually born in Cataloochee and was a ranger there for, as they say, 100 years. Well liked by everybody and all that sort of thing. So I've got a character. I started from that character to develop a kid named Jim Hawken. And Jim quickly becomes absolutely nothing like Mark Hanna, except that he has this job. And Jim is a country boy from Cataloochee. He works his way over to Western Carolina, and he doesn't take a degree because he never would take any English courses, and they wouldn't give him a degree without that. But he had a lot of native smarts and that sort of thing, very personable young man. He goes to work for the Forest Service, and he's stationed over at Bent Creek at the Experimental Forest. And from there, he goes to church one afternoon at the Presbyterian Church close by, and he sees a young woman there, just falls in love with her, and she falls in love with him, and they get married. And he has convinced her that Cataloochee is paradise, and they're going to have just a great marriage there. And the problem with Nell is that she's a city girl. And her mother, well, her mother has problems and pretensions. But anyway, Jim has married into an awfully interesting group of people here. And let me read you just a little bit about the trip that he and the in-laws make when they're moving their possessions into Cataloochee.
Please do.
That might tell us a little bit about the decline that we're watching here. For the first part of the journey through Canton, Clyde, and Waynesville, Henry, this is Jim's father-in-law, flashed his headlights often so Jim would stop and the women could stretch their legs. They shared a picnic lunch of cold ham, cheese, and sliced bread inside the general store at frog level. The proprietor wanted them to eat on the porch, but Elizabeth charmed him, that's Jim's mother-in-law, Elizabeth charmed him with the promise Henry would buy sodas. "Jim, where in the world are you taking us?" asked Elizabeth. "I had no idea such a place existed." "This is Waynesville, Mother. It's civilization, and I don't have a lot of use for it. Wait until you see the valley. It's the prettiest place in the world." His mother-in-law rolled her eyes at her husband. Halfway toward Cove Creek Gap, any appreciable width of road was eaten by serious switchbacks. Jim was glad not to be in the Chevrolet with his in-laws. He got along with his in-laws, but he preferred small doses and could barely stomach his father-in-law's cigars. This way he enjoyed the sights. A gray snow patch beside a laurel thicket. A hint of winter warbler in the periphery. A branch freshly broken from a huge hemlock, white wood dangling over the road like a sword. A perfectly clean entrance to a skunk den in the end of a dead chestnut. A boulder whitewashed with bird droppings. A stalk of Joe Pieweed bent but unbroken by wind and weather. Brown oak leaves clattering in the breeze, refusing to fall. A buzzard soaring in lazy arcs above the valley. The truck flashed its lights and stopped suddenly. Nell and Mac stumbled out, followed hurriedly by Elizabeth. Mac is Nell and Jim's little boy. Jim chose not to embarrass his mother-in-law by watching her retch into the roadside bushes. "How's little Mac?" he asked, but Nell simply gave Jim the boy's hand and walked down the road. "Honey, what's the matter?" Jim yelled. She turned, pouting. "Where in creation are you taking us?" He looked at Mac, a grin at his father. "Home," Jim said. Henry dipped a sizable handkerchief in a roadside spring and handed it to his wife. "This is the worst road I have ever tried to drive." "At least there isn't much traffic," Jim said, as all clustered around him. Elizabeth, pale as dried pine rosin, looked up at her son-in-law. "Are you sure there are houses there?" "Trust me, Mother, we didn't grow up in mud huts. You'll love it." Elizabeth straightened her hat, found a compact, and refreshed her lipstick. She took Mac by the hand. "Well, we simply have to make the best of it, don't we?" she said, and piled them back into the cab. They crossed the gap and started down by the deserted Sutton farm at Turkey Cove. Black silhouettes of thistles thrust 3 feet high in their pasture. Poison oak, honeysuckle, and bittersweet grew on fence posts. A crow perched on the point of their barn roof like a weather vane. Toward the bottom of the mountain, things looked more normal because Old Man Bennett, the son of the original Old Man Bennett, whose house was burned during the Civil War and rebuilt by the old man and his namesake son, was so far too stubborn to leave. His place in the curve of the road was kempt. They crossed the wooden bridge about 4 and turned sharply left. In a quarter mile, Jim In a quarter mile, Jim pulled beside a darkened house and parked. The Chevrolet backfired and dieseled to a stop. Doors creaked as the passengers emerged. The metallic thud of closing doors echoed off the barn like an ash can lid beaten by a tire iron. Jim had never seen Lige Howell's house without occupants or chimney smoke. The left-hand wing had been a standalone cabin converted to a kitchen for Lige and Penny's boarding business. In the gloom, it looked tiny and cold. Across the dog trot, the squat two-story frame addition paled against the drooping sky. Elizabeth, who had been raised a Baptist, thought it cold as that hymn about Greenland's icy mountains. She laid the back of her wrist to her forehead, said, "Lord, save us," and fainted. Henry sat her on the edge of the truck seat and fanned with his handkerchief. "Son, what in the world?" "It's fine," he said. "I'll just go in and build a fire or two." Well, you can sort of tell that this is not going well. And the upshot of this is, this particular chapter is that Nell, Jim's wife, defies her mother, who says, "You must leave here now. No mm-hmm. civilized person could ever live here."
Yeah.
And Elizabeth and Henry go back to Asheville in the Chevrolet truck and leave Jim and Nell and the kids there to find out whatever kind of life they're going to have.
Uh-huh.
But it's not the same place that it was
right.
in 1925 or so. It's yeah. really not the same. There's not enough neighbors. There's not enough. One of the places you see the decline is in the general store, uh-huh. Which used to be crammed full of merchandise and now has empty shelves. And the proprietor has a bad end in here.
Sort of
as a reflection of what's happening with the valley.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So it's not a pretty tale, but it's there's some interesting and humorous events in it.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But I had fun doing Nell and her mother.
Were they from Asheville? Was that the city that they were
mm-hmm.
from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering whether it was, you know, the major metropolis of Asheville, which must have had at that time, what, 20,000 people or?
Maybe
50,000.
Let's see. Asheville in 1928 was at a boom.
Yeah,
they were
that's
probably
right.
at around that's 55 right. at that point,
yeah.
and then it sort of
declined.
Had its own decline after the Panic of 28.
Right, right.
But, The fantastic growth in Asheville was from 1880 when the train came
right.
To 1928, and the bottom fell. Well, actually, the panic started in 26
with the collapse of the right. Florida boom.
And
yeah.
As a matter of fact, we really need to get Requiem by Fire on the shelves because there are some awfully timely situations
yeah.
in here that
yeah.
I was not actually trying to predict what's happening in 2009 and 10, but there's some things in here that are
interesting congruences.
Yes. Yes. I have one chapter in here, by the way, where a couple of my characters go to Asheville, and they go to Asheville on the day the central bank crashed.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And a character from You Can't Go Home Again just sort of wandered out of there and sort of wandering around in my story. I'm
well,
not quite
great.
Sure where that came from. But
that'll fascinate the scholars down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the one that I really want to see, if anybody catches, and I'll just throw this out here for whatever posterity might listen to this,
uh-huh.
Bud Harrigan, was born in Providence, Tennessee, and he, at the end of this book, we find out that he and his new wife just had a son named Gene.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see if anybody remembers who Gene Harrigan was in Cormac McCarthy's work.
Oh.
I just want to see if anybody remembers that. That's all.
Homage to favorite authors.
Exactly. 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 The world's worst inside joke. But I would love for Random House to get a copy to Cormac. I mean, we're in the same house, so I'm sure that that could happen.
Right.
I don't
right.
know if they can get him to read it or not.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
It's dancing time, the clock says 10. Won't you say when? I'm ready, go steady, when we begin. The time is right, I think we might just chance it and dance it away tonight. My time is your time. Your time is my time. We just seem to synchronize and sympathize. We're harmonizing one steps and two steps, old steps and new steps. There's no time like our time, and no one like you.
You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5, Asheville, North Carolina. Now let's get back to our conversation with Wayne Caldwell. Well, let's pick another section of the new book. This is Requiem by Fire. Something that'll give us this, suggest the story arc, as it were.
Let me read a little section, fairly late in the story.
Okay.
I can find it here right quick. It's there's a character in here who's really nasty. I have to say in advance for anybody that's listening who's wondering if these characters really came from Cataluchi, I don't know where this guy came from.
Uh-huh.
But he's certainly no one like that ever lived in Cataluchi.
No. No. Maybe he wandered in from one of Cormac's books.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, now that may be exactly where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
This chapter is called No Farming. Silas Wright is now a widower, living alone in the house that, if anybody has hiked Cataluchi and been to the Woody House, this is where we are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Silas woke to rain's rhythm on the shake roof and the steady southern breeze through his open window. He turned from back to side and closed his eyes, but within a minute raised up like Lazarus. Who in hell was Miss Agnes? He had dreamed about his brother Paul, dead 60 or more years from a gunshot through the head. What they never knew was who pulled the trigger or why. A right-handed man, Paul lay dead in the bedroom floor with a four-hand 32 pistol in his left. His wife and mother-in-law were both in the building, but neither admitted to having seen a thing. Silas had been at the barn when he heard the shot. When he tore into the front room, Paul's wife knelt by the body, cradling her husband's right arm in her lap and wailing. Her mother stood in the front doorway, arms akimbo, expressionless. Coroner's inquest ruled a suicide, but they never knew. Paul was a happy-go-lucky man who could double you over in laughter with a particular turn of phrase. Whenever he heard something extraordinary, he'd whistle and say, "Well, kiss my ass, Miss Agnes," with heavy accent on every second word. Silas sat on the edge of the bed and shook the cobwebs out of his head. "Well, kiss my ass, Miss Agnes," he said and smiled. How long had it been since he had heard that? At least 50 years, and he could hear his brother's high-pitched nasal voice perfectly. "I was barely 20 when they found Paul over 60 years ago. I'm 84, nearly 65 years. I'll be damned. I'm about to get old." He lit the lamp and dressed by its flickering light. He almost never looked in the mirror over the washstand, but this morning lingered at a scarecrow of a man, lined like a bad road. If he thought of himself at all, it was as a man of 30 with a head full of brown hair and ears unlike an elephant's. He shook his head as he raked a wet comb through his hair, covering bald patches big as tomatoes. "All this is some old son of a bitch the government's about to evict," he said, frowning. In the kitchen, he lit lamps, built a fire, and checked on a funnel spider beside the wood box. "I won't kick you out, old man," he said, peering into a silken cone in which legs were poised to grab breakfast. "If they send me out, I'll take you with me." He sighed, poured a drink, and sat at the table upon which lay a letter. August 22, 1934. Mr. Silas Wright, Cataloochee, North Carolina. "Dear Mr. Wright, replying to your letter of the 22nd, I regret to advise you that all lease fees, both state and federal, are cash in advance, and I cannot make exceptions to this rule. Indeed, I might add, no farming will be permitted until the fees have been paid. Regretting my inability to give you more time on this, and trusting that you will give the matter your prompt attention, I am, yours very truly, J.R. Evans, Superintendent." The letter Silas wrote, which occasioned this reply, had asked for lenience. He had mentioned that these were hard times and asked permission to make his annual lease payment, $60, in September after he sold his cattle. Until then, he did not expect to lay hands on even 2 bits worth of cash. He had posted the letter with some optimism. Where that had found its source, he could not now say. He put on a pot of coffee. He'd seen worse times, during the war, when neither salt nor coffee were to be had. This depression, as folks were beginning to call it, hurt everyone, but he had plenty to eat and drink, unlike back then when a month's rations might be a peck of potatoes. Folks were now hollering, but mostly because they weren't old enough to know real deprivation. Salt and coffee and meat and potatoes were still for sale. Only trouble was, people now had thought good times would go on forever and had not squirreled away even a buffalo nickel. Silas's father, Jonathan, had always said a man needed to keep a little something, the whereabouts of which were known only to himself and God. Jonathan followed his own advice, but had the bad judgment to salt bills away in a pasteboard box. During the depression of the 1880s, he discovered mice and mold had spent it long before he unearthed it. Silas kept a few $100 in mason jars hidden under a bedroom floorboard. He counted it every now and then, pleased by the ring of coin and glass and the musty smell of wrinkled dollars. He could pay the government, but it was the principle of the thing. He had asked nicely, without sarcasm or bad humor. Evans's reply was curt and officious, and to Silas' mind deserved a reprimand. But who was his boss? Secretary of Interior? Somebody like that. And it goes on from there, but you see the dilemma that these folks who chose to stay were facing. That letter, by the way, was kindly given to me, or a copy of it was given to me by Stephen Woody, whose grandfather actually received that letter. So that's an actual historical letter that I was lucky enough to be privy to. The rest of this chapter, Silas goes to talk to the warden, Jim Hawkins, about this to see if Evans is serious about this. And on the way, he meets some people camping. And he's just amazed that people are stupid enough to camp out in the rain. And this is what the valley's coming to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's this is very deeply into the book. This is page 303 of my typescript. The typescript's about 370. So right. This is what it has come to at this point.
Yeah.
And
so the outside world impinges more and more on the valley. Bringing lots of newfangled folks and things.
And things, yeah. There's one detail in here. Silas is in the general store, and he asks the storekeeper, "What are these things?" Well, they're he's selling light bulbs for automobiles.
Gads.
Yeah. Got to change, man. You got to change with the times. Yeah. Well, you know.
Pretty high tech.
Selling camping supplies.
Yeah.
this project has been a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd had a little more time to devote to it, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
And we'll see how Random House accepts it here in the next week or two. Yeah. I'm hoping I'm not going to have too much revision to do on it. My editor says that they have scheduled the book for the spring list of 2010.
2010, okay.
Which, right. In
next year,
my guess would mean that it would be on the shelves maybe next March or April.
Mm, something
like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you given much thought to the third book? I know you've contemplated it as a trilogy.
I have given some thought to it, yeah. I had... People have asked me about a character in Cataluchi named Ras Carter. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be more about Ras in the second book? And I've told, yeah, there'll be a lot more. Uh-huh. Well, there ended up not being a lot more about Ras.
Shucks.
Yeah, and I think he deserves a whole book.
Yeah.
And the way I'm envisioning Ras's career right now is that I know he's a student at Chapel Hill. He's a sophomore at Chapel Hill when the book ends. Uh-huh. And I'm thinking he's going to graduate about 1936, and then he's going to law school. Mm-hmm. And he's thinking about opening a practice when World War II is looming on the horizon. Right. So he joins the Army. And I'm very much hoping that the Army's going to send him to Italy, because I want to ride off a trip to do some research. So
maybe we'll Assisi.
Well, there wasn't all that much fighting there, but I do know a little bit about the campaign for Anzio and that area in there, and I've never been there, so
I
think that would be a good place to go.
And that certainly expands the geographical scope.
I'm not thinking that this third novel is going to be so much a Haywood County novel as it is just going to be maybe a North Carolina mountain novel. Uh-huh. You perhaps know that I was involved in the 80s, with the very early 80s, with the Downtown Mall Project.
Right.
And I'm thinking that in the 80s, Ras is going to be, as they say in his law firm, off counsel.
Off counsel.
He'll be retired, coming in the office every now and then, and he's going to be the pro bono lawyer that helps these kids defeat this downtown mall.
Oh, good. Good.
Anyway, that's sort of what I'm thinking. I have no idea if it'll turn out that way, but I think I do need to devote a book to Ras, and we'll just see how he ends up.
How he develops, as it were.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, Wayne, thanks so much for reading for us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Yeah. I enjoy it, and I hope your audience does too.
Well, I'm sure they do. They'll be downloading it you know, like crazy, by the thousands. So there you go.
If they're interested, by the way, www.waynecaldwell.com has part of the first chapter
okay.
posted, and good. They're also posted some interviews and things like that. So try the website.
Okay, and that's www.waynecaldwell.com.
That's it.
That's great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And that's Wordplay for this week. Thanks so much to Wayne Caldwell for sharing Cataluchi and his new work as well with us. Something to look forward to about a year from now. It's Requiem by Fire. You can get more information about Wordplay programs at naturespoetry.blogspot.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.